Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. The U.S.-Israel war on Iran has entered its third week, and there does not seem to be an end in sight. More than 1,300 Iranians have been killed. Israel's ongoing bombings in Lebanon have killed over 1,000 people, and according to the UN, 1 million people, one-third of them children, have been displaced. 14 Israelis have been killed, and 13 U.S. soldiers have been killed. Last Sunday, when Trump was asked about the soldiers who've died, he ignored the question, waved his hand, and said, "Go ahead, who else?" Joining us to discuss the latest and media coverage is Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and author of the forthcoming book, Crossing the Red Line, which is about the Biden administration's failures in Gaza and beyond. Hi, Akbar. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me back, Rose.
Akbar, I want to ask you a question about the legality of all of this. What has been very disturbing is hearing hosts and people on the radio and television talking about what is happening in a very casual way. I mean, we are talking about bombing Iran, the retaliatory strikes. People are losing their lives. Infrastructure is being destroyed. How are you seeing anyone in the media ask if this is legal and what precedent this is setting?
I think there's been a long-running pattern of media coverage, unfortunately, fixating on quote-unquote brilliant tactical successes, right? And this idea of, oh, look, there are U.S. fighter jets operating in this place. Look at this heavy machinery. Look at these tankers. It fixates a little bit on these shows of power and force. And there's a feedback loop between officials and media in these ways, right? Journalists who kind of fetishize that sort of demonstration of muscle are not asking bigger questions about strategy, costs, as you outlined, Rose, off-ramps, the potential for diplomacy to achieve these same goals. That said, there are some reporters pushing back. And if we're talking about legality, we have to note that this is a war that's really legally dubious on two fronts. There's the international law question. The U.S. has not demonstrated through any evidence that there was an imminent threat of attack from Iran, either to the U.S. or to Israel. So under international law, the right of self-defense has not necessarily been triggered, and we haven't seen the U.S. even attempt to rally countries to support the war in some serious international legal way. And then there's the U.S. law question. I mean, Congress has not voted to fund or support or authorize this war, and you do have an increasing number of lawmakers and some journalists who are saying, why aren't we having that discussion? But again, Rose, that takes us back to really the last 25 years, almost pre-Trump, I mean, including other Democrats, where really these questions of legality and open debate about war have been shoved to the side. And instead, there's been celebrations over assassinations or raids or drone strikes, while, of course, broader instability and risk to human life has increased.
Akbar, I also want to mention that today is the Persian New Year. And I just want to say happy Nowruz to our Iranian listeners, especially to senior producer Malih Razazan, who has been working so, so hard on these shows. I want to spend some time talking about Iran, because I think this is also getting lost in the conversation. I've been really surprised that more people have not asked, why is it that we're not seeing videos of what is happening inside Iran like we did in Gaza? We were watching in real time the destruction that Israel did in Gaza, the Palestinian journalists who taped, you know, family members losing their moms, their dads, their children, buildings being destroyed. We watch this day after day after day. And I'm very surprised that people have not been asking, why aren't we seeing this come out of Iran? It is because there has been a mass communications blackout. We've done a lot of shows about this. It's really difficult to get information about what is happening inside Iran because of the regime. And according to Iran Human Rights, On January 8th, the authorities shut down the internet and carried out an unprecedented mass killing of protesters using military-grade weapons. Thousands of Iranians were killed. Many more were detained or denied medical care. Iran Human Rights has documented these crimes. Has that surprised you that more people are not wondering why we're not seeing more footage of what is happening inside Iran?
I think the personalization and the sense of empathy for Iranian society, even compared to Palestinian society under US-backed bombardment, which is continuing, by the way. There was just a strike yesterday in Gaza City that killed four people. Yes, I think that there's a little bit of blindness to that humanity, and it speaks to how often communities abroad are painted with a broad brush, right? So as Trump administration officials remind us every chance they get, the US has not had relations with Iran since 1979. It's been in opposition to the regime. However, of course, the regime is not the entire population of 90 million people in Iran who are very vulnerable. And in fact, many of them have been suppressed and targeted by that same regime. So I do think that we could be doing a better job trying to weed out those experiences, to pursue those narratives from Iranians, from people in diaspora who are in touch with family members. Because what we're hearing, I mean, what I sort of heard from someone earlier this week, it's just this sense of total, almost surreality, you know, in the sense that how are we in the situation and there is no sort of clear way out because there's no clear war goals from the US or from Israel. And the goal from the regime, as you've said, is A, kind of retain its control domestically, and B, really emphasize these shows of strength abroad. So the Iranian people are really victims and sort of both being victimized, forgotten, and then also kind of instrumentalized. Because don't forget that the American-Israeli narrative, in particular the Israeli narrative about this war, is we want to see the Iranian people rise up and topple their regime and create a country that's more stable in the Middle East. Unclear how they're expecting that to happen, of course, under total bombardment and under policies that are encouraging a further regime crackdown from a regime that, of course, is very willing to suppress its people.
I'm glad you brought this up because on March 17th, the Washington Post had a piece by John Hudson. Israel urges Iranians to revolt, but privately assesses they'll be slaughtered. And I'll just read from this piece. Senior Israeli officials have told U.S. diplomats that Iranian protesters will, quote, get slaughtered if they take to the streets against their government, even as Israel publicly calls for a popular uprising, according to a State Department cable reviewed by the Washington Post. What is your thought on this, Akbar? This came out recently, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention.
It's the tiniest sliver of hope that there are still at least some people within the U.S. government after the assault on the State Department and the assault on independent thinking within the government under the Trump administration, who seem to understand Iran to a degree. I think this gets to a question of why did we really get into this war, right? Because even for the Iranian people, reeling from that crackdown in January that you mentioned, and reeling from years of a struggling economy because of US sanctions, was this really the right time to try to incite an uprising? Was it actually realistic? It speaks to the question of these kind of mismatched analyses of the situation. And again, the sense that President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, in partnership, but also because of their own choices, ended up in a position where they're just putting a lot of people at risk, Iranians, Americans, and many, many others across the region.
And going back to what Iranians are dealing with inside Iran, the comments that I have read are by people who want to remain anonymous because they are frightened for their lives. And we should also mention that according to Iran Human Rights, and we'll play a clip, state media reported that protesters have been executed. Saleh Mohammadi, Saeed Davari, and Mehdi Ghassami, who were accused of participating in the murders of two policemen during protests on January 8th. The executions were carried out in the presence of a group of people in Qom. These are the first hangings in relation to the nationwide protests. And I want to play this clip from ABC. They report that Iran executed three men for their alleged role in anti-government protests, according to Iranian state media.
Iranian state media reports a 19-year-old wrestling champion was executed in Tehran for his alleged role in anti-government protests. Authorities say he and two others were convicted in connection with violence during January unrest. The regime is thought to have killed nearly 7,000 people in those protests, with thousands more deaths being investigated. Human rights groups condemn the executions, calling the trial unfair and based on false confessions. Amnesty International estimates that more than 30 people face the death penalty for protesting, including two 17-year-olds.
What is the media's role in ensuring that these voices and what is happening inside Iran to Iranian activists and protesters and people who risked their lives are not lost during all of this?
I think there's a real role that the platform we have, and some folks have tried to do this. I mean, I give credit to, I think the FT has a really strong Iran correspondent still. Of course, you saw the Washington Post lay off its Iran correspondence earlier this year, a really surreal move. What I've tried to do with my platform is also shine a light on people who are just in the most vulnerable positions. Earlier this year, I wrote about Reza Velizadeh, who is an Iranian-American journalist who's imprisoned. And so when we're thinking about the crackdown, and again, those who are vulnerable, those who are already targets of the regime, already in facilities where they are often mistreated, they are denied access to their families, denied access to any real legal representation or redress, those people are so much more vulnerable in a time of war. And Reza Velizadeh, this Iranian-American, had been in the previous U.S.-Israeli war on Iran in June 2025, less than a year ago. He'd already been moved into harsher conditions. He had been exposed to some of the effects of an airstrike. And it just boggles the mind to think about, as, again, the U.S. and Israelis say, we're pursuing regime targets, we're pursuing military targets. Okay, but if you're pursuing internal security, that will include necessarily those groups and those militias and those officers who are pursuing innocent people and protesters. And the canary in the coal mine for me, as I was reporting out that story on the Iranian-American journalist detained now for more than a year under the Trump administration, which has promised to prioritize Americans detained abroad, is that the Trump administration did not raise these cases of Reza Velizadeh or any other Iranian-Americans in its talks with Iran preceding the war. So kind of any concern for humanity for Iranians has not been clear. I mean, the sanctions relief that you've seen from the Trump administration has been on Russian oil, potentially Iranian oil. You're not seeing sanctions relief for humanitarian recourse for Iranians.
Akbar, you have so many contacts inside the State Department. I'm wondering how many are still there. You did so much great reporting under Biden. Are you hearing anyone in Washington saying that this devastating war needs to end?
Thank you for saying that, Rose. State Department and, you know, across agencies dealing with national security. And what I'm hearing from some of those officials is yes, there is frustration. There's a sense of where are we headed? But there's a bizarre almost resignation to President Trump does not seem interested in an off-ramp. And it's in a way almost, it builds on itself. It's a snowball effect, right? Let's just look at the history quickly. He chose to leave the Iran deal. He chose to pursue a military buildup. He and President Biden, in between the two Trump presidencies, chose to empower and embolden Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, who's always wanted a U.S. war in Iran. So now it's that much harder to roll any of that back. So while there are officials who are internally providing warnings, providing assessments, there's also a sense of the president has really centralized decision-making around himself. And what that means is not only are national security experts, nonpartisan career people who've been in and may have some skepticism, they're not getting through to him. It really depends on who he's on the phone with. And as we know, that can include anyone from golf buddies at Mar-a-Lago to Senator Lindsey Graham, a really serious Iran hawk. So what I'm hearing from officials is a lot of fear. And I want to highlight, especially I'm hearing from some service members, active duty, and also some reservists, who are talking about their fear that about these increasing deployments of US troops to the region, another deployment authorized and reported by Reuters just this morning. These people feel they are going into a really volatile theater with very little cover, very little support, and no plan.
We're speaking with Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and author of the forthcoming book, Crossing the Red Line, which is about the Biden administration's failures in Gaza and beyond. If you'd like to join us and talk about media coverage of the U.S.-Israel war on Iran and how it has really reached so many other countries. Again, over 1,300 Iranians have been killed. Over 1,000 people in Lebanon have been killed. According to the UN, 1 million people in Lebanon have been displaced, one-third children. 14 Israelis have been killed. 13 U.S. soldiers have been killed. If you have a question for Akbar Shahid Ahmed, he has been constantly reporting on this. He's got a lot of contacts inside the government and in the Biden administration. If you have any thoughts about media coverage, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Akbar, so many people say that this could end if the United States pulls its support. Is that what you're hearing?
You know, I think that there's a role the U.S. could play in terms of stopping its airstrikes, even potentially limiting weapons to Israel. But we haven't seen President Trump or his top aides seriously consider, certainly not consider limiting support to Israel, which is driving the Lebanon war, as you mentioned. And even the question of stopping airstrikes on Iran, it's not getting much play at the highest levels. In fact, what I'm hearing is a lot more escalatory options are being taken up to the president, including, terrifyingly, you know, the use of potentially tactical nuclear weapons. Mm. So if we're thinking about that kind of escalation, that shows you the direction of what's heading up to the president.
What are you hearing about nuclear weapons?
There's a concern that, but what President Trump has indicated is he really wants to be seen as a history-making, precedent-shattering president, right? Willing to do things that past American presidents, who he presents as weak failures, were not willing to do. And so there's a concern among some in government that there's an active discussion and consideration of use of this, both from an ego standpoint and from a perspective of this would be a dramatic escalation against Iran, and perhaps be enough for the U.S. to then say, look, we were clearly tougher than you and we're going back. But important to remember, too, Rose, is that it's not just the Americans. I mean, the Iranian regime now has clearly made a strategic calculation that it wants a longer war. It doesn't believe that diplomacy with the Trump administration is going to get it anywhere. So Tehran is also escalating in big ways. I mean, targeting energy infrastructure, targeting Gulf states. And so even if the U.S. were to stop bombing tomorrow, I'm not sure that that would stop Iranian missiles, drones, or other attacks.
You know, Trump keeps giving incoherent and confusing reasons about why he decided to join Israel in bombing Iran. He said that it'll be over when he, quote, feels it in his bones. Who is making the decisions here? Is it the United States or Israel? The New York Times has a piece today called Israel and the U.S. are starting to show their different priorities in Iran by Stephen Erlanger. He writes, Israel launched a major attack on an Iranian gas field this week, prompting retaliation by Iran against Gulf states, a threat to global energy supplies, and a surge in fuel prices. Trump first insisted the U.S. knew nothing about the strike, then backtracked and said he warned Israel against attacking the complex. So who's in the driver's seat here?
I can't help but feel echoes, Rose, of the Biden administration and the Gaza war, where we started to see as the war was clearly getting just more and more devastating to no clear strategic end, we started to see more of these stories of people saying, oh, well, the Israel and the U.S. are diverging. I think the decisions that are being made are fundamentally President Trump's. And so he can come out and say, I don't want responsibility for this particular attack on a gas field because it's shared with Qatar. The Qataris, of course, have deep business ties with the Trump family and members of his inner circle. These are the people who gave him the $400 million luxury jet last year. So there's an incentive for him to deny that. But again, he could say no at any point. So I'm a little skeptical of some of his coverage saying officials are starting to diverge until we see some kind of clear, specific action. And right now, all the actions from the Trump administration are pointing towards we want to escalate. We, as Trump officials, want to go in this direction. And that's a product, to a degree, of what President Trump has been told by Netanyahu and by allies of Israel in the US. It's also a product of the real hubris that he developed about military action after going into Venezuela, kidnapping the country's president, after his war in Israel last year, after an ongoing campaign of boat strikes that is clearly, according to many experts, violating international law. That's all Trump. So I do think that the agency does still rest with President Trump, who could choose a different course and hasn't shown he will.
What about Senator Lindsey Graham's role in all of this? The Wall Street Journal had a piece recently by Joss Dossey earlier this month, Lindsey Graham's quest to sell Trump on striking Iran. He reports few people lobbied Trump to undertake the riskiest gambit of his presidency as effectively as the hawkish and persistent Graham, who over a decade has held a sometimes close, sometimes tumultuous relationship with Trump. And he reports, to help make the case on Iran, Lindsey Graham traveled several times to Israel in recent weeks, meeting with members of the country's intelligence agency. Graham said, quote, "They'll tell me things our own government won't tell me." He spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, coaching him on how to lobby Trump for action. Netanyahu showed Trump intelligence that persuaded him to go ahead, said Lindsey Graham. What do you make of this?
Lindsey Graham is someone who has wanted an aggressive U.S. campaign against Iran for so long, and of course served in the Senate with now Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio, who also was a big Iran hawk. So these relationships are hugely important. I think the benefit that Lindsey Graham can also give as an interlocutor is that it doesn't look like all of this is coming from the Israelis. He can put an American spin on it, put an American political spin on it. Say, President Trump, this would be good for you domestically. And so I think that's where he's a key player. He's also been someone who has had issues with Netanyahu in the past. Trump has had problems with Lindsey Graham. We haven't seen those bubble up in recent years. Instead, we've seen more of a proximity, more of even a personal closeness. And if you look at the people, the Americans I'm now talking about, who, yes, there's a convergence of interests with some in Israel who wanted this war, but Americans who have been pushing this war, they are very uniformly white men of a similar age to Trump, similar to a degree demographic, who very much have ties to the Republican Party and the conservative base. Mark Levin, Lindsey Graham, and those are people he takes seriously.
I also want to play a clip from Netanyahu. At a press conference this morning in Tel Aviv, CNN's Jeremy Diamond asked Netanyahu who is calling the shots.
I don't think any two leaders have been as coordinated as President Trump and I. He's the leader. I'm, you know, his ally. America is the leader, but ultimately, President Trump makes his own decisions. And do I respect them? Yes, I do.
The question is whether you would or could continue the war without the United States. Could you without the United States? Without the refueling capabilities, for example?
We're going to close. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister.
You exhausted your questions.
So what do you think about that, Akbar? Jeremy Diamond says, can you continue this war without the U.S.? And he refused to answer the question.
Well, and we know the answer, right? We know that it's U.S. military support that makes not only the Israeli bombing runs in Iran possible, but the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and this potential permanent reoccupation of southern Lebanon. That's been something Israeli officials have conceded going back again to the Biden administration, to post-October 7th. Prime Minister Netanyahu is a really savvy player of American politics. He's been doing this since the early 1980s, when he was a junior diplomat posted here in the US, and of course has personal relationships going back to, for instance, sleeping in Jared Kushner's childhood bed in New Jersey. So what Netanyahu is doing here is understanding he needs to tread carefully with Trump. He doesn't want disappearance of any kind of rift. I do think that there are others who could convince Trump, look, Netanyahu is taking you for a ride. But so far, that doesn't seem to have gotten any traction.
Akbar, I'm thinking that a lot of people maybe would have said, wait, what? Netanyahu slept in Jared Kushner's bed in New Jersey? Can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is Netanyahu was a personal family friend of the Kushner family. And so on one of his visits to the US, I mean, that's where he stayed, right? So it just shows you how these relationships go way back decades. And shows you how there is a personal element to this. It's not necessarily a strategic thing either for Israel or the US. This is so much about legacy for Netanyahu, his ongoing quest to perpetuate wars so that he doesn't have to face political consequences at home and potential jail time for the ongoing corruption cases against him. What's stunning is, Rose, that President Trump positioned himself as I am so much savvier than Joe Biden, who is, you know, incompetent, leading to a world of chaos. However, while knowing who Netanyahu is, what his interests are, what his tendencies are, he looks to be getting played by Netanyahu in very similar ways to Joe Biden.
I want to end talking about Lebanon. A number of people have gone on social media over the last couple of weeks talking about how their apartment in an apartment building in Lebanon has been completely destroyed by Israeli bombs. And here is Malak Harb reporting for the Associated Press.
Israeli strikes hit across Lebanon overnight, several hitting areas in central Beirut and its southern suburbs. In central Beirut, where Lebanon's health ministry said 10 people were killed, residents and first responders at the scene told us that they once felt the heart of the capital was safe, but now feel otherwise after the overnight attacks. Israel had previously concentrated most of its strikes in southern Lebanon or in Beirut's southern suburbs, where the Hezbollah militant group has a strong presence. But strikes early Wednesday, several that came without prior warning, hit neighborhoods in the city center. There were also strikes in the country's south and in the Bekaa Valley in eastern Lebanon. And in Tir, dozens of cars gridlocked the streets as families rushed to flee, many going to the neighboring city of Sidon. The evacuation comes at a time where the government is struggling to find shelter for all the displaced families. Since the latest round of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah began, more than 900 people have been killed and over 2,200 wounded in Lebanon. Even as the violence continues to spiral, there does not appear to be a diplomatic off-ramp to end the fighting anytime soon.
Akbar, can you tell us about the piece you wrote, Israel is applying Gaza logic to Lebanon with Trump's blessing?
Yes, Rose, there's a real concern that the Israeli strategy is to decimate neighborhoods and areas in Lebanon and sort of claim that that's justified because Hezbollah had support from the communities living in those areas. Now, what we know is that, firstly, support for a militant group does not necessarily turn an entire civilian neighborhood into fair game under international law. That's simply not the case. Also, we know that often this has been a backfiring strategy. This has only led to more people supporting these groups. But because there hasn't been accountability for what happened in Gaza, there's a lot of fear among Lebanese and also among people I talked to again in government that why would the Israelis feel they have to stop here? They've never been held to account either for war crimes under international law or under US law for these wars. And what's also really critical to remember is that the Trump administration holds so many cards here. And I've continuously asked sources inside the admin, are you all thinking about Lebanon? Because what I do hear from other sources, foreign government sources, is Iran cares immensely about Lebanon. From the point of view of Iran, any deal with Iran would need to include a ceasefire in Lebanon. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of calculation in the Trump administration for how to reach a settlement here, a settlement that would need to address Israel's security concerns regarding Hezbollah, but also address the fact that Israel is now expressing a desire to permanently hold parts of Lebanese territory, something that just is unacceptable for millions of people.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed is senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and author of the forthcoming book, Crossing the Red Line, which is about the Biden administration's failures in Gaza and beyond. Akbar, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Russ.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will speak with The Lever's David Sirota about his award-winning podcast, Master Plan, which exposes the 50-year plot to legalize corruption. We'll also talk about The Lever's coverage of the U.S.-Israel war on Iran. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.